Hello, I'm Ben Harmon, the Director of Stills, a photography centre and charity based in the heart of Edinburgh. You're listening to Photography Down the Line, a podcast aimed at sharing the ideas of artists, photographers and other people we're in touch with from the photography sector. To learn more about Stills or to support our work, please visit us online at stills.org, and thank you for listening. Hello, am I speaking to Stephen Koch?
Yes, you are.
Stephen,
to Ben Harmon.
Yes. You are indeed. Thank you so much for sparing the time to speak to me for this episode about Peter Hujar. And of course, it will be interesting for people to find out a little bit about you as well. To start with, I wondered if you'd mind, you're an author, a writer and a teacher, but you've become the executor of the entire artistic estate of Peter Hujar. I wondered if you could start by saying how you met him and how that came about.
Well, I met him very early on. I was still, believe it or not, very young. It was 1965. And I was a young writer beginning to break into print here and there. And I came to the attention of Susan Sontag. And Susan Sontag was very impressed by my work. We got to know each other. And I became Susan's protege. I was doing a lot of work, and she was taking me around, introducing me to influential editors and things like that. And it was all very intoxicating. One day I was there in her apartment, and she said, "Don't go yet. There's a very interesting person dropping by later, and you might want to know him." And I said, "Fine." In he came, Peter. And he always made a very strong impression. Tall, very good looking, exact, self-contained. And he sat down, I remember, in a rocking chair in which he did not once rock. He sat there, but he'd had a very amusing day. He was then working in commercial studios, and why he worked in commercial studios is worth exploring sometime. But he was happy to work in commercial studios. He was increasingly important in those places because he had made himself over the years very proficient technically. And he'd spent the day photographing someone who may now be a completely forgotten figure, but she was famous then. Her name was Jane Mansfield.
Yeah.
And Jane Mansfield was the sort of clown version of Marilyn Monroe. That is, this great, beautiful, blonde bombshell. But she was also a kind of figure of fun, frankly. And he'd spent the afternoon photographing Jane Mansfield and observing her whole family, which came along, and her parents, her husband, and noticing her. And I noticed that as Peter described her and her relation to her own body and to the camera, to her nakedness, for example, she did not go behind the screen to change into the next so-called fashion that she was showing off. It was like listening to a wonderful novelist describe something. He was very precise. You got the picture very clearly. And I was very struck by him. After that, Peter and I were acquaintances because we lived in more or less the same world. There was a big difference between our worlds in the sense that I was much more involved in the academic world and Peter had nothing to do with the academic world, nothing. But nonetheless, we were very much in the same kind of ambiance. And then in 1972, so we're talking about 7 years later, I had known him for 7 years as an acquaintance. And he, at this point, Susan developed breast cancer. And it was a very dire case of breast cancer. And I was very involved with all of the events that were surrounded that. And one of the things that was necessary, she's going to go into Memorial Hospital, which is the great cancer hospital in New York City, and have an exploratory surgery to discover exactly how bad it was. Her son and I, and as I remember, one other person whom I can't recall, all went with her to check into the hospital. She had a very nice room. She was settled in. Everyone was, of course, on pins and needles. And she suddenly said, oh, wait, I forgot something important. I promised Peter Huejar I would write an introduction to his book, Portraits in Life and Death. Bring me some paper and a pen, which I did. And already in the bed that she was going to be in, she sat putting a bunch of, I guess, magazines on her knees to write against. In about half an hour, 25 minutes, something like that, she wrote what still stands as the introduction to Portraits in Life and Death. And not incidentally, it's very much musing on a relationship between death and photography, since she was wondering whether she was going to live or die. When she got done, she gave the handwritten manuscript to me and said, will you type this up, please, and take it to Peter in the morning? I did type it up, and I went, and that was the first time I ever saw the inside of his loft. We had a brief conversation. After that, we kept meeting on the street here and there. Pretty soon, I was inviting him to dinner, or we were going out together. And eventually, we became very regular friends. And in my opinion, I believe that he was my best friend, in the sense that Peter had a tremendously attractive gift for intimacy. He loved seeing people only one-on-one. He'd sit at this blue kitchen table, and you'd sit on the other side of it. And you'd end up talking about very intimate and personal things. And he was listening and was always very intelligent, sometimes a little strange, but very intelligent about what he heard. So I thought he was my best friend. When he died, as Nan Golden has said, his grave at the Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Westchester was surrounded by people, all of whom thought they were his best friend. he was certainly my best friend. Okay, how did this happen? When he developed AIDS, first of all, my wife and I were very much involved in the movement toward a diagnosis. He had come to our apartment. We were decorating a Christmas tree. He helped us decorate the tree, and in the process kept saying that he had a little bit of a problem, which was that he had difficulty getting out of bed. My wife, who's a physician, talked to him for a while, felt the glands in his, under his jaw, and made what was very rare for her an incomplete or wrong diagnosis, because she wanted it to be wrong. She thought that it was either AIDS or some such illness like it, or depression, because Peter was a depressive and he would go through cyclical depressions. And she said, okay, let's call it depression, because that's what she wanted it to be. And it is a very rare occasion that she gets a diagnosis wrong, but of course, it was AIDS. We were very connected to the whole process of his treatment. And also his own preparation for the end, because in those days, diagnosis of AIDS amounted to a death sentence. And at that point, Peter began to worry about what he should do with his work. He was, I don't know what he went through privately. I don't know what fears he had. But he worried about it a great deal. I know of three people that he considered. One was the photographer, Lynn Davis. Another was the photography critic, Vince Aletti. And another was me. I was on this list not because I knew a tenth as much about photography as the other two candidates. I didn't. But Peter thought I did have certain traits that would work for me, work for him. He thought, first of all, that I would be loyal. That is, I would really do it. 2 years hence, I would still be doing it and not goofing off or handing it off to someone else. And then I would take the task very seriously. He knew that was true. And he thought, I think correctly, that of the three candidates, I had the best head for business. That is, I didn't know anything like what ought to be expected for a huge executor about photography, but I did know how to negotiate an arrangement. In the end, Lynn, as I remember, dropped out. Vince and I, he went back and forth on us. The reason being, Vince knew so much about photography and I didn't, and that I was so good at business and Vince wasn't. In the end, he chose me. And it was momentous. I once wrote an article in Harper's Magazine about what it was like to have this incredible body of work put in front of me. And from that point on, I was involved in a daily consideration of the welfare of this amazing body of work. It was true that when he died, he was what I once called in an essay, he was secretly famous. He wasn't famous at all, but he was secretly famous, by which I mean that there was a small coterie, a very elite coterie of people who thought of him as a great photographer. Lynn Davis was one, Richard Avedon was another. Interestingly enough, Robert Mapplethorpe was another. And then there were a group, and Vince. And then there were a group of friends that he had around him. Many of them very interesting people. But he was otherwise unknown. So my first task was to get him to be known, bring his work out of underground obscurity and into visibility. And that was my first big job.
You've said that Peter somehow knew that he would become recognized after his death, and in many ways that is true, that you would know better than anyone else that during his lifetime he didn't have that recognition other than amongst these peers that you've already mentioned. Could you say a little bit more about the sort of late recognition for his work as you understand it?
By all means. Many people have said that Peter was not successful, to put that in quotation marks, successful in the very world they sense of this work being thought to be valuable, published everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. Because he was artistically and morally too pure to play the commercial world. That is a, I would say not a half, but a one-third truth. He was someone who had very high standards. But he was also someone who craved, very much wanted, would have loved to be famous, a celebrity, meeting with famous people, being admired from a distance by all kinds of people that he would have loved. It would have tickled a kind of vanity in him. It was there, was very real. But, and this is the crucial but, Peter was, for some mysterious psychological reason, unable to advance his own interests professionally. He simply couldn't do it. It drove me crazy that this brilliant man had to live on a pittance. He was the poorest grown up I'd ever known in my life, known well. Oh, by the way, despite his poverty, he never gave the impression of having no money. He seemed to be almost aristocratic and untroubled by money, but he had no money, nothing. And I'll give you an example, two examples. I've got a box full of them. At one point, he'd been to our house for dinner, which he did about once a week, and he said, next Tuesday, I've got this collector, this sort of famous collector, who wants to come to my loft and look at art. And I said, Wendon, wonderful. Let me know how things go. The next time I saw him, I said, well, what happened to Mr. So-and-so, the wonderful collector? And he said, who? The wonderful collector. Oh, him. Yes, him. He came into the loft and said immediately something so very stupid I had to ask him to leave. That was Peter. He threw it up. At his memorial, Fran Lebowitz said from a podium, Peter Huszar has hung up on every important photography dealer in the Western world. And that's not literally true, but it might as well have been true. He, in some way, could not surrender possession of his work to outsiders, to people. And Peter and I discussed this ad nauseum. We were on and on and on about it. It's not like he was indifferent to success. On the contrary, he was very interested in success. But he was mainly interested in why he was psychologically, almost spiritually forbidden to him. And that made him think that his work could only be successful after his death. Many people knew this. I knew it. I know Fran Lebowitz knew it. One day he came for dinner and said, I've been thinking, when I die, I'm going to be buried in two graves. He said, one grave will be for me. Not more than 10 feet away, there will be another grave into which will be put all of my work, all my negatives, all my notes, everything, and buried beside me so that it can't become known after I die. Well, that was a mood that passed, and instead he gave the job to me. One thing that I might mention to your audience if they are interested in artistic estates.
Yeah.
Most people aren't. Most artists aren't because they're not interested in what's going to happen to them to their work after they die. And most other people are simply bored by the subject. But Peter was, I think, and of course it's to my advantage to think it, very intelligent about that. He knew and was explicit that you must not leave your work to the person you love the most. That should be done only if the person you love the most is capable of doing the job, which they almost never are.
Mm.
The person Peter loved the most was, at that moment in his life, certainly David Wojnarowicz.
Mm.
And he, I don't think that he ever even thought about leading the work to David. He may have discussed it with him. I have no idea what their private conversations were like. But he said, don't leave it to the person you love most. And above all, don't leave it to a committee.
Mm.
There should be one person, and only one person, running the show. Why is that? And he said, because the three people will end up hating each other with absolute assurance. Why is that? He said, well, if the estate does badly, they'll blame each other. If the estate does reasonably well, they'll wonder why it didn't do better. And if it does very well, they'll be rivals for the reward. It's not going to work. There must be one person.
Mm-hmm.
He was very clear about that. And oddly enough, I don't quite know why this should be true. He decided also that the one person should have complete control that and should be therefore the owner of the estate. It's not simply that I was the executor of an estate that was otherwise entailed. I was the owner of the estate.
Mm.
And his, that was a very important part of it. And financially, I should say that it took at least 2 years after he died to pay off his debt.
Mm.
I paid for his funeral. David Wojnarowicz designed his tombstone, which had to sit in the granite shop forever until we got X $1,000 necessary to pay it off, and so forth.
Mm.
But that was it. I began to understand Peter's work in a new way.
Mm.
And inform myself on what it takes to manage an artistic estate, which is quite a lot, and about which I knew nothing when I started.
Do you think he'd seen examples of other photographers or artists passing away and estates being dealt with in a, you know, it becoming very difficult? Do you think he'd learned from seeing something else happen? Or,
yes. Yeah. I think that's true. He told me, first of all, at that point, many people that we knew in common were dying.
Mm.
And I knew of one case. I don't know if Peter did, but I knew of one case of a photographer, very charming guy, which for the minute I'm not remembering his name, but he was a very well-known photographer. His name appeared everywhere. He died. He has relatives in some small town in the Midwest. They came in to grieve over his death and packed up his works, took it back to the small town in the Midwest and put it in the garage.
Mm.
End of his whole reputation. He's now totally forgotten.
Mm.
It's not that they had anything against him. They didn't know what to do. They had no idea what to do. Peter then told me that a photographer he greatly admired. He thought maybe she was the greatest photographer alive, was Lisette Modell.
Mm.
And he told me that Lisette Modell had, in his opinion, very wisely given her entire artistic estate to her dealer, who had a lot of commercial reasons to make it work. In fact, he was incorrect about that. He'd been misinformed, but it shows what his thinking was like. And he knew that the estate would probably make some money, which in due course it began to do, very slightly. When he told me, I was taking him to a hospital for what he thought was his final hospitalization. It wasn't, it was his next to last hospitalization. And I was leaving, and just as we got to the door of his loft, he turned to me and said, "I've decided that you're to have the pictures." And next he said, "Since he knew my wife and I wanted a child, you're to have the pictures, send little Madeline to college." Then he added a typical huge art stinger, "You're no good, but you're the best I have." So that was it. But he knew that it would be enough to send it, if we had a little Madeline coming down the road, she might be able to go to college on the proceeds of the estate.
Yeah. Did he have a preferred subject matter? Obviously, when you go, when you look online, and I should draw people's attention to peterhujarchive.com, you see a lot of portraiture, different kinds of subjects, but then pictures from travels in Italy and so on. Did he regard himself mainly as a portrait photographer?
I think that's correct. He believed that people with a strong artist calling, which he certainly had and believed he had, should not limit themselves to any generic single route. But portraiture fascinated him. He used to spend a great deal of time in the Metropolitan Museum, absorbed in the portraits of the very great painters, Velázquez, for example, and had lots of ideas about portraiture, about photography and portraiture. And he once said to me, "I would love to make a portrait of a tree," by which he meant not a picture of a tree, a portrait of a tree. And what he meant by that is not clear, but in a way he succeeded in doing that. So he had that. He was very, very little interested in documenting any world. He was interested only, as he said to me once, "When I do a picture, I do everything." He said, "That's not much difference between what I do and what Julia Margaret Camden does." You frame up the picture, you take the negative, you develop the negative, you make the print. It's got to be beautiful. Which is a crucial word. It's got to be beautiful. By which he meant beautiful in his terms, so that if you look at his work, you can rest assured that he thought this was beautiful in some way. And I would say that's one of the keys to his work. Another thing he said, "I know when a print is done if it seems to have its own life. It seems like a living thing to me." And until then, it doesn't. He maintained those standards for himself, always. I think that he knew that he was one of the very impressive photographers alive. I think he knew that, but he never said that. And I have to say that once I got the job, I sedulously avoided using the word great. He's a great photographer, here's a great picture, et cetera, et cetera. Simply because I didn't want it to sound like a lot of salesman's hot air. It was only after he started being regularly referred to as great in some of the more important publications that I dared use the word myself. There was a tremendous pride in his work. He once said to David Wojnarowicz, "The love of my life is my work." Not David Wojnarowicz, but his work. All of that was very, very important to him. And his portraiture counted. One of the aspects of his emergence as a very well-known figure, you know, he's not as well-known as he's going to be, but he is still very well-known now, is that he is seen as a kind of forerunner or pioneer in breaking down the barriers between straight and gay definitions. And that is true in one sense. He did not see any reason for him to censor in any way the aspect of his sensibility that was gay. Therefore, not surprisingly, he was more interested in male nudes than female nudes, for instance. He did a number of beautiful female nudes, but there was that. As he was dying and instructing me, because I used to come with a notebook and write down his instructions to me. He said, "Always remember, I want to be remembered as a photographer who was gay, not as a gay photographer." And I felt that I knew exactly what that meant at the time. I was very careful not to let him get sucked into any kind of operation that was really kind of high-tone, softcore porn. That was anathema to me. But what has happened in the world socially since his death has changed a lot. It was still, in 1987, a hard sell to have a photographer who was so obviously gay in much of his work become well-known. Now, you can point to a lot of other people who were well-known and quite gay, no problem. But it was difficult. It was seen as, I remember one dealer saying to me, "Well, this is all quite wonderful work. I don't think it has much future, maybe with a few rich gay collectors, but nothing more." And that was a stab in my heart. I was very upset by it, but I couldn't say it wasn't true. And I now feel mixed feelings for the way Peter is seen as a kind of pioneer. That is, he saw no reason for his sensibility not to shine through every aspect of his work. He really didn't. And he knew that was very unusual. And I think now it helps that he's acquired this position. And he's not a gay photographer in the sense that Baron Van Gogh nor even George Flat Lyons are gay photographers. They are. Peter is not that. But it is true, the emotional substance of a great deal of his work is erotic toward his own sex. Yeah.
Mm. And as well as all of that, he printed his own work. He was very, very highly skilled at the craft of photography.
Correct. He was... I'm trying to talk about how that began or what it was like. First of all, he did believe that printing your own work was the dividing line between the serious photographer and the not serious photographer. He believed that pictures were made very good by the way they were printed. And he brought all his subtlety and thinking to that process. And he was dismissive of photographers who didn't spend time in the dark room. For example, Robert Mapplethorpe. And the way he got his training is a sort of interesting story. He was a real child of the slums. His father was a bootlegger. Bootlegger is understood in the UK, right? A maker of crooked whiskey.
Yeah, sure.
And who abandoned his mother when she was pregnant, and a mother who was a waitress in a diner. So he was raised in poverty. Luckily, the New York City school system of that time, and I believe it's still true to a certain degree, recognized that he was no ordinary fifth or sixth grade. That he had something special, that he was unusually intelligent and unusually talented. So he was sent to one of the advanced high schools in the city for unusually gifted people, where he had as his English teacher a now moderately well-known poet named Daisy Alden, who came to him when he was a student, probably around 16, and said to him, I'm making this up in terms of making it, I don't know the exact words. She said, Peter, you don't know it yet, but you're an artist. That's who you are and what you are. You've got to learn to live with that and develop it because that is what defines you as a person. Extraordinary thing for a high school teacher to say to a young kid. And she said, as a result, and the art you're interested in is photography, which it always was. She said, as a result, you must realize that photography is an art that requires technical expertise. You can't just go and snap a picture and say, I'm done. Therefore, she said, I want you to draw up a list of the most important commercial photography studios in New York, maybe 10 or 15 of them, bring them to me, we'll go over them, and you are going to go and ask for a job of any kind whatsoever in one of them, somewhere. if you have to sweep the floors and clean the toilets, that's what you'll do. But you must begin to live in a world of very high professional standards. Very interesting thing for a teacher to do. She's a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
He did it. He ended up, he was 16, he had to lie about his age because you can't, in New York State, you cannot hire as in full-time work someone under the age of 18. It's against the law. Mm. He was 16, so he lied about his age and that worked. And he started to work in the studios and began what was this amazingly fully developed, technically proficient life, set of skills.
Yeah.
And at the same time, tensions grew with his alcoholic mother and her alcoholic second husband. And somewhere around this same time, in the midst of the shouting match from his mother, she threw an empty liquor bottle at him. It smashed against the wall near his head. At which point he turned, walked out the door, age 16, and never returned. That was the end.
Yeah.
He ends up getting his own probably really dirt cheap apartment somewhere. I think he slept on Daisy Alden's couch for a long time.
Mm.
And at that point onward, he was involved in self-sufficiency. Whether there's a debate now going on about whether Peter's relationship to his mother was uniformly hostile, it was by the time he died.
Mm.
Whether it was when he was still young is not quite clear, but nonetheless, that's what happened. He walked away and started living on his own at age 16, working in a photography studio.
Mm. And did he spend a long time working for other studios before he established his own working from his loft?
He always knew that he was going to do what was his work and the studio's work.
Mm.
They were, in his mind, two separate things. Occasionally, they would cross.
Yeah.
Some of his better known pictures were about commercial assignments. Not many, but some.
Mm.
He left commercial photography altogether around 1972. And it was not because he despised commercial photography, because it was commercial and et cetera, et cetera. He felt life was short and he had his work and their work and he had a priority for his work.
Mm.
And he devoted himself full time. He then began to, I imagine when he left the studios, he had something almost resembling a middle-class income.
Mm.
And he went to being very poor. Which he handled with great style. And lived marginally on offhand jobs that came his way. One of the things I can remember, one point I had a girlfriend who was none other than a photography editor of Fortune magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw Portraits of Life and Death in my apartment and said, "What is this?" And she said, this is amazing. What is this? And I said, "He's a very good friend of mine. He lives on nothing." And she said, "Well, we're going to put a stop to that." And she then would regularly, like every month or every 2 weeks, call him up and say, we want you to go to Wall Street and take a color portrait of a given banker in his office. So he would do it, and they would pay him $300 a picture, which was magnificent. Mm. So it was on that kind of odd, goofy, unlikely set of events that he lived most of the time.
Yeah.
He'd always been poor.
Yeah.
His childhood had been poor. And for some reason, unlike other people around him, for example, Robert Mapplethorpe, who managed to change, transform the work of being a fine art photography into a dazzlingly successful commercial enterprise.
Mm.
I mean, Robert died a very rich man. Peter knew that. There was a rivalry between them, although I should add that the very first picture sold by Peter Hujar after his death was to Robert Mapplethorpe.
Gosh. Yeah.
And it was sold for $500.
Mm.
I had announced at some final gathering that from now on, no photographs of Peter would be sold for a penny less than $500.
Yeah.
Which sounded so reckless to me. I mean, I can assure you, Peter was never paid $500 for any one of his works, ever.
Mm.
A big coup might be $350.
Yeah.
Fairly usual.
Which
Yes.
I was just going to say, which photograph was it? Do you remember?
Yes. It was a portrait taken on a farm in upstate New York of a horse running, galloping horse. Very beautiful.
Yeah.
And Robert liked it a lot and had no trouble paying them the exorbitant $500. And that was that.
Yeah.
So, yes, to return to your original question, Peter was someone who was pure and had standards so high that easy commercial success would never have satisfied him or worked for him.
Mm.
He didn't mind in his young years working in thoroughly commercial circumstances and these studios. It's doing nothing, taking pictures of, you know, green peas on a plate, which he did.
Mm.
There was that high standard, but there was also the fact that he could not permit himself worldly success. I've since then come to wonder, and of course I'll never know this, it's impossible to know, whether, deplorable as that was, it wasn't also something that served his art very well. Mm. He was never seduced into the glamour world of New York, where almost every other significant photographer of his time moved and had their being.
Mm.
Including Avedon, who he greatly admired, and many of the rest, a name almost of any very well-known name in photography. They are people who did high profile photographs of celebrities, for example.
Yeah.
He didn't have anything against them doing it. I never heard him speak. I think Lisette Modell was the only photographer I never heard him say one negative word about. But he did say negative things about a lot of other people, including Avedon, whom he knew well and cared about a lot, and was cared about in return.
Yeah.
But whatever he said about Avedon, he never attacked the fact that Avedon was a brilliant businessman that made himself very rich.
Mm. Stephen, I should probably start to wind down a little bit, but I wondered what's next for the archive, what plans do you have for the future?
Well, there are a few things. Managing an artistic estate that has become known and successful and sought after is very different from managing an artistic estate that does not have those advantages.
Mm.
I now have to deal with the successful Peter Hugo.
Yeah.
That is, in worldly terms, the successful Peter Hugo. And that's coming along very well. I think that there will be a significant documentary made of his life. Portraits of Life and Death will soon be reissued in a very, very elegant and beautiful and widely distributed edition.
Fantastic.
His big retrospective, beginning at the Morgan Library and ending at the Jeu de Paume in Paris, was a very, very successful enterprise. I'm very grateful to the curators who made it possible.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to see that in Paris. It was an absolutely beautiful exhibition. It was incredibly busy. It was really, the work was being loved, for sure.
Yeah. Here's one thing that maybe would be useful as a way of signing off. When I got this job, I said that I didn't understand much about the art of photography beyond what a sort of well-educated New York kind of intellectual would know, i.e. not much. And I was troubled by the fact that I had been asked to promote and develop work that I myself thought of as, quote, difficult.
Mm.
That is, I thought there was very often something in all of Peter's pictures that push you away as well as invite you in.
Mm.
I'd look at it and I had this kind of naive, now embarrassing thought, Peter is a wonderful picture, but why can't it be more beautiful? Why can't it be beautiful the way pen is beautiful? Would that be so hard? And I blush to confess that I had that kind of, I didn't, thank God I never said that to him. It would have ended our friendship, but I thought it. And I wasn't alone. He was regarded as a difficult photographer who reached beautiful things via often very ugly things.
Mm.
And I remember a conversation I had with Robert Mapplethorpe before he died. I mean, before Peter died. And I asked Robert for his opinion about Peter. And I think I can quote, I remembered it almost exactly. He said, well, Peter is a great photographer. Everybody knows that. Love to know what he meant by everybody, but everybody knows that. But he said, when I put something on my wall, I don't want to look at it and cringe. Have to back away from it. So he was one of the more sophisticated practitioners of photography, saying something much like my reservations. Mm. But 30 years later, all of that has simply vanished. Mm. Nobody says such things anymore. What is beautiful about Peter's work is quite evident to half the undergraduates in the country. Mm. And I'm fascinated by that transformation, that what time has done to, I mean, I worked hard to get Peter out of obscurity, but one of the things that's happened is that the nature of what is beautiful in his work has become obvious historically in a way that it was not originally.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me and for all the work you've done to share such beautiful work. And I would recommend everyone listens to this who hasn't seen much of Peter's work to look at the archive website, peterhujararchive.com. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah.
Let's do it again sometime.
Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.